Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. On this show, we're joined by scientists from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. The nonprofit is dedicated to the search for life beyond Earth. Later on in the show, we're joined by Sophia Sheikh, who conducts the search for extraterrestrial civilizations by looking for signatures of technology. She'll join me for a discussion about the famous Fermi paradox. The renowned Italian physicist Enrico Fermi posed the question famously and simply decades ago. If there are alien civilizations out there, where are they? But first, our guest is Simon Steele. Simon is the deputy director of the Carl Sagan Center for Research at the SETI Institute. Simon joins us now to talk about the Institute's involvement with the Disney Pixar film Elio, which tells the compelling story of a boy trying to find his way in life when he's mistakenly beamed up to the Communiverse, an organization of alien beings far and wide who mistake the 11-year-old for Earth's ambassador to the universe. It's a touching story about establishing unexpected relationships, and it's based in part on science from folks at the SETI Institute like Simon Steele. Simon, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you very much, Dave. Good to be here.
Well, we have you on to talk about a Disney Pixar film, Elio. And how did the SETI Institute become involved with Pixar?
Yes, it goes back a few years. First of all, it's so exciting to be involved with Pixar. You know, the SETI Institute is an institute that does serious searching for aliens. The SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And so when Pixar decided to do a movie along that theme, we're very happy that they approached us. And initially approached Jill Tata, who is a scientist here at the SETI Institute, one of the founders, really, of the Institute and of SETI science, that is the scientific search for alien life, going back now to the 1960s. So when they wanted to get a bit of realism into this fantasy story, they approached the SETI Institute, which is wonderful.
Yes, I love Jill, one of my favorite people in the world. And I'd like to know just a little bit about your background before we plunge into some more of this Disney Pixar stuff. Tell us about how you came to the SETI Institute.
Oh, I came here about 6 years ago from a vast, you know, distance away, a galaxy far, far away called England, where I was a lecturer in astronomy at a university in London. I've lived about half my life in the US, mostly on the East Coast. And my background is in extragalactic astronomy. That is, I like studying galaxies and I like studying black holes. But I think, like all astronomers, deep down, we have a fascination with life in the universe of all its forms, whether it's little microbes on Mars or alien civilizations. The SETI Institute, the idea of the search for life elsewhere, I think we all grew up with, certainly in my generation, you know, growing up with Star Trek in England, you grew up with Doctor Who, lots of aliens in that. And then more seriously with Carl Sagan and the TV show Cosmos, which really put a scientific angle saying this isn't just fantasy, this isn't all made up. There's a serious search and possibility that there's life elsewhere.
Okay, let's talk some more about movies, and we'll get into some more of Elio in just a moment. But, you know, extraterrestrials and Hollywood go back to the very origins of, you know, our sci-fi films back in the 50s. And then, you know, of course, the pinnacle, I'm sure for you and folks at the SETI Institute, was Contact, which was written by Carl. And based, the character of Ellie Arroway was based in part on Jill Tarter. It's such an interesting and rich history, like Steven Spielberg's E.T. And now you've got this new iteration. Tell us about like what it was like working with Pixar to kind of bring the real science into the entertainment business.
Yes, and I think it's a tricky balance in entertainment. You want to have that scientific accuracy because it makes it feel authentic. It makes it feel as though it could happen. Although if you're in a Pixar movie, you don't need that necessarily that level of realism. It's really a tribute to their team at Pixar that they wanted a scientific basis to the idea of searching for alien life, just as Contact did. And I think the interesting thing about Contact as a movie is that the process of SETI, the whole idea of radio astronomy and trying to detect what are called technosignatures, that is signatures of technology using radio telescopes. The first half of that movie was very accurate to what actually happens in science and in SETI research, even down to the funding issues with the federal government, which is true for most science.
Even worse now.
Even more problematic now. Absolutely. And just as an aside, the SETI Institute is a nonprofit organization, and it does a lot of work that is government-funded, NASA-funded. But the SETI research itself, that is the search for intelligent aliens, has not been federally funded since the 90s. You can search for non-intelligent aliens, that is microbes and that sort of thing, but the search for intelligent aliens is all privately funded. This is through donations. And so, you know, that in itself makes it difficult because, you know, big scale science is not cheap. So it's a tribute to those who have given, you know, donations, not just to the SETI Institute, but to the science as a whole, to keep things going. It really is a project of the people.
And can you give us a sense of what it was like for folks from the SETI Institute to be involved, to go to Pixar Studios and to, you know, just interact with the movie makers? Because there is an interesting crossover. And Disney has a rich history of this, of, you know, the science and technology of animation and making films. They've always been on the cutting edge since Snow White, you know, back in the 30s. Can you tell us about what that experience was like for folks from the SETI Institute?
Personally, it was very, very exciting. Having never been directly involved with the making of a film, Jill Tarter got involved very early on, and I think her fingerprint, if you like, is definitely evident throughout the film. I was lucky to go and chat to the production team towards the end of the film, just to talk about some of the fine tuning, which was exciting and intimidating, especially as I was thinking I was going to speak to about three or four people, and the whole production team showed up, which was wonderful. But there was a big audience there. You know, they were very, very interested in the science of SETI. They were fascinated by what we were doing. There was sort of, I suppose, mutual awe and admiration. not for me, but you know, for the concept of the SETI Institute and the actual search for aliens, which was something they were trying to replicate in the human aspect of the Elio story. So, you know, a lot of interest in what's it like in the control room of a radio telescope that's searching for aliens. What would you do if that signal came in? How would you respond? Who would you tell? And I think that, you know, that was a fascinating discussion about post-detection. How do you react as a scientist? How would you react as a human to that?
Yes, I've often thought about, because I fly fish the Hat Creek Valley area a lot. And I've visited the Allen Telescope Array many times over the years since it's the very beginnings when I was up there with Jill and Jack Welch. And, you know, it's just, I love the history of that place. Ansel Adams photographed it back in the 60s when it was the University of California, Berkeley Radio Astronomy Lab. It's just a really cool place. And I often think to myself, what would it be like if this, you know, literally became the scene in Contact? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, the helicopters and the government and everybody's rolling in, all the media, because it would be quite a circus up there.
It certainly would be. Yeah. And the roads will get very, very congested. It's a wonderful sort of contrast between, you know, the sort of the ancient bucolic scenes of Lassen Volcanic National Park. You know, as you say, you've got cattle, you've got fields, you've got very little country roads and a ring of gorgeous volcanoes. And then in the middle of it is this facility that is straight out of science fiction.
It sits out in those stark lava beds, and which are kind of unworldly looking, you know, on their own.
Absolutely. And you know, the for those of you who haven't seen images of it, it's an array of dishes rather than the one big radio dish that you sometimes see. And in the movie Elio, they replicate that somewhat. It's cheaper to build a lot of smaller radio telescope dishes that operate as a team, as one, than it is to build one gigantic dish. And a lot of the modern radio telescope facilities are like that. And there are 42 dishes at part of the ATA, the Allen Telescope Array, and they can work in unison. They can work separately to look at different parts of the sky, spread out over about an acre or so of a field up in Lassen National Park. Yeah.
Did anybody from Pixar go up there and check that out?
I am not aware that anyone did. We certainly shared a lot of images of it. And of course, they would have seen, say, the movie Contact, which doesn't feature the ATA itself, is out of the very large array, the VLA, all these letters.
In New Mexico.
In New Mexico, right. And the Arecibo Observatory out in Puerto Rico, which sadly is damaged beyond repair because of a hurricane a few years ago. I think it was Hurricane Maria. I can't remember.
Yeah.
So those are the images that you see on the movie. The Allen Telescope Array is a slightly smaller setup to the VLA, which is the most powerful radio telescope in the world, but the same concept of multiple dishes. So they modeled it very well in the film. Some of the scenes at night with the dishes in pointing up into the sky were very atmospheric. They did that well. I think the control room in the movie is slightly more impressive than the control room at the ATA, which looks like somebody's home office rather than...
It's kind of small. Yeah. It does what it has to do.
It does. It does. Yeah.
And you mentioned that Jill Tarter's fingerprint can be seen in this film. Can you give me any examples of that? Perhaps you just did, but, some other examples of, Jill's influence on this film?
I think there are a couple of maybe concrete ones. I think... the fact that the Golden Record and the Voyager probe were so heavily featured. I think some of them are slightly more subtle ones, where one of the scientists had a T-shirt with the Drake equation on his T-shirt, which was a wonderful thing to see. And we can spend another 3 or 4 hours talking about the Drake equation. I think also... the human aspect of it, of the discovery of alien life. Jill has always said that the search for aliens is as much about human psyche as is about discovering alien life. And I think this idea of awe and wonder, but also it goes back to how we feel as humans as to what's happening is very, very important. So
that ancient question, are we alone?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. There are ham radio operators in the film, and that came through in Contact as well, where Ellie Arroway was a ham radio operator tuning through the frequencies, try and detect another operator, another transmitter. And that's basically how radio astronomy works. It's tuning a radio dial to pick up those transmissions, because radio telescopes pick up a lot of artificial transmissions every day, and most of them are the human transmissions rather than alien ones. That's always a problem. We've got so much human technosignatures coming down that it's very difficult to pick out the ones that are not from humans.
And you mentioned, of course, the famous Golden Record, but for folks that may not be familiar, because, Voyager was launched, as you said, in 1977, a long time ago, it really is a message in a bottle, isn't it?
It is. It's an example of METI, which is messaging extraterrestrial intelligence, and where you're sending out information about yourself out into the universe. And on the side of these two spacecraft, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, that were launched in the 70s, basically to look at the large planets of the outer solar system, are heading out into interstellar space. They're both about twice as far away from the sun as Pluto is at the moment. And on the sides of these spacecraft are actual records. Now, records are back in fashion, so people know what records are. All these particular records are made of gold because you need something that will survive the hostile environment of outer space. But on these records are sounds and also images, very, very basic, what we call sort of GIF images, really, these days, of the sounds and sights of Earth. And sending this information is interesting in itself, because what do we want to tell about the story of Earth to other civilizations who would have no concept at all of society, of our planet. What's important to us to put in this bottle, as you say, and launch it into the cosmic ocean? And that was choices were made back in the 70s that, you know, some of them are good and some of them maybe are not representative of all humanity and all Earth. But, there was music, different types of music from around the world. There were voices. There's whale song, bird song, and things like that. And the chances of it ever being found are very, very slim. These spacecraft could actually be traveling for millions of years out into the galaxy, but maybe picked up one day, and maybe there will be the only legacy left of our pale blue dot. But, you know, as we say, it's more of reflection of what do we want to say about ourselves than what we think aliens are going to get out of it.
Yes, and you mentioned the Drake equation, which we've done 2 hours on this program. We did a two-part series on it. So I'm going to give you a minute. Can you, or a minute. 2 minutes maybe. Can you just give us the elevator speech version of the Drake equation?
Yes. So Frank Drake, a radio astronomer back in the 70s, was a co-designer of the Golden Record with Carl Sagan and active at the SETI Institute, and tried to put forward the question of how many aliens are out there. And this effectively impossible question to answer can be broken down into bite-sized chunks that science can actually tackle. So N equals, that is the number of communicating alien civilizations, and N is at least one because that's us. But the question is it two or is it three or is it 3 million? And we don't know. And to try and answer that, this equation, which is more of a roadmap, although it is a functioning equation, is designed to try and put estimates on that, but more importantly, designed to allow us to think about how do we try and answer these questions. How many stars are formed in our galaxy? Those are easy questions. How many planets go around those stars? These are questions that science can answer at the moment very, very accurately. But as you move down the terms of the equation, then it becomes more tricky. The fraction of planets that have life emerging on them is very, very difficult, but an active research area. How much of that life will become intelligent life, and how much of that intelligent life will actually communicate across the stars? We have a lot of intelligence on this planet, whales, dolphins, crows, but at the moment it's just humans, as far as we know, that can communicate across stellar distances. And if you try and address each one of these as a separate research area in science, it allows you to try and tackle these big questions. But, you know, we still don't know what the answer is.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Simon Steele, Deputy Director of the Carl Sagan Center at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, as we discuss the new Disney Pixar animated film, Elio. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we visit with Simon Steele from the SETI Institute, as we talk about their involvement in the new Disney Pixar film, Elio. And I like in the film, Elio, the main character, he's a little boy who's just kind of lost trying to find his way. Mm-hmm. And figure out, you know, where he fits in and having difficulty. But he's fascinated by the stars, and somehow, some way, these extrasolar civilizations have some kind of an organization, and they figure that he's the representative for Earth. And, you know, then he goes on this great adventure. And it has a lot of really, from what I can see, a lot of really cool messages to give to kids about repairing relationships and things like that, mm-hmm. Which is quite lovely. I'm wondering what kind of feedback you've gotten from, you know, maybe even families of people that work at the SETI Institute taking their kids to go see it.
I think a lot of people, I think the families of people who work at the SETI Institute is a very biased audience, but they seem to.
Well, their kids are their own audience, though.
That's right. I think it's a beautiful film. and it is a film that people can relate to. Although Elio obviously takes this journey, and as people see this film, it takes this journey as a form of escape, because there's a feeling that his own life is not working through friendships, through family. And so it is a flight of imagination that everyone is, you know, who's young has. An extreme one is to be swept away by aliens to become part of what's called the communiverse, the interstellar sort of a community of aliens. It's a dream that we can all relate to in a way. And, you know, I think everyone we've spoken to really loved that adventure aspect of it. And the aliens in them, of course, we don't know what aliens will look like. We don't know how they can communicate with us, if they can ever communicate with us. But it was a very interesting exercise to actually bring some astrobiology to the story as well. Because a lot of the characters, a lot of the aliens, may be a little bit based on actual science. The Elio's best friend in the end, called Glauden, looks a lot like a tardigrade. And you know, going
water bears,
the tardigrades, they're other name are water bears. These are tiny millimeter long creatures that look like little grazing eight legged cows. And are so cute, but had this ability to survive in the most extreme environments. They're called extremophiles. And so this type of organism, not only, you know, from Earth can survive, you know, even in the vacuum of space by going into hibernation, but maybe examples of creatures that can survive in extreme circumstances, on other worlds. So that was pretty neat. There's a creature that definitely looks though it's made of rock. And so the idea is, you know, is all life in the universe based on carbon? These carbon-based life forms that you hear from Star Trek, is carbon the way that you actually construct organic systems and life systems? The answer is probably it's one of the best ways to do it, but maybe there are other ways you can do that. And so another friend, Tegman, I think the name of the character is in the movie, it looks definitely made of rock, which suggests maybe silicon is possibility of that. That's the sort of basis of the chemistry on the world that they are from. So, you know, there's a lot of science sort of hidden away in this fantasy adventure, which is really neat.
One of my favorite episodes of the original series of Star Trek is the Horta.
Yes.
Mining the that planet. That's where they live, and they are silicon based. And I love the scene where Spock mind melds with the Horta.
I think Star Trek, the original series, still my favorite. It's a bit creaky in parts, but the concept that, and I think Elio is the same in that you come across these aliens that seem very hostile and alien in the literal sense of the word, very sort of different. And as you go through the film or through a Star Trek episode, you realize actually they're not that different. You know, there's an intelligence where there didn't seem to be initially. There's a way that you can bond with these creatures, even though they're so very different. And that came through very much so in the original Star Trek, where, yes, there are problems and adversaries in space, but on the whole, the life forms that you come across have similar goals and similar sort of aspirations to humans. And Elio is the same. Even, you know, the evil bad guy turns out to be just a stressed father in many ways. And then I know that's like, I never plan to take over the universe. It's not, at least, you know, I've still got a bit of time for that. But, you know, it's this idea that, and the question is that a human trait? You know, we're projecting in a human trait that deep down we are very, very similar, even though there's superficial differences. That we have the same sort of aspirations and need for friendship, need for communication, even though we're very, very different and very, very different backgrounds. And Star Trek did that very well. It's a very good social commentary. Of course, at the moment, we don't know if that's a universal trait or just a terrestrial trait.
Well, and that's one of the fascinations of what you do at the SETI Institute, is to try to to answer those questions about what would life be like beyond Earth?
Yes. It will be nice to have a second data point on this graph. It'll be very interesting. I think that we are closer than ever in several ways to at least put constraints on how much life there is in the universe. You know, certainly with the new generation of space telescopes, new generation of ground-based telescopes that are being used, the ability to detect exoplanets, planets orbiting other stars, and the ability to analyze their atmosphere to potentially get signs that those planets are habitable will, A, not only tell us the sort of the type of life forms that live on those worlds indirectly, because, again, we're not seeing what's living, but we're seeing, an influence on the planet based on the life that is existing on those worlds, will give us a sort of much more a sort of statistical breakdown of life and where it is and what type it is. And it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, it's going to take who knows how long, it could be. SETI is a generational science. It's not a quick answer science. I always give the analogy of building a cathedral. You know, this lay the foundations, as Jill Tarter and Frank Drake laid the foundation of SETI. It's going to take several generations before you put the last capstone on the roof. And it could be a long time before we actually answer the question, are there other intelligent aliens out there? But as soon as we find one other example, I think then we'll find hundreds, because we'll know what we're looking for. We know the similarities and the differences between us and other alien life forms, about how they communicate and how they are visible to us.
Yeah, can't recognize the pattern until you know what the pattern is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, Simon Steele, Deputy Director of the Carl Sagan Center for Research at the SETI Institute, it's been a joy to talk to you about this Disney Pixar film, Elio, and the SETI Institute's involvement with it. And just thanks for joining us. It's been fun.
Been a great pleasure. And definitely go and see the film. That's fun, too.
Thanks to our guest, Simon Steele, Deputy Director of the Carl Sagan Center for Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. And now we're joined by another scientist from the SETI Institute, Sophia Shake. Sophia is a researcher who specializes in looking for signatures of life and advanced technology, and she's here to give us her take on the famous Fermi paradox, which in essence asks the question, if there are alien civilizations out there, where are they and why haven't we heard from them yet? Sophia Shake, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Okay, I got to start with your title. Techno signature research scientist. Tell us exactly what that means.
So the word techno signature is kind of a new piece of jargon in the SETI field. And it's really just shorthand for the things that SETI is looking for. So signs of alien life with some sort of technology out there in the galaxy or even further in the universe that we could detect using telescopes and other astronomical instruments from Earth.
Very cool. And just I'd like to know briefly, you know, give us a little bio about you. How did you come to the SETI Institute? How did you first get interested in this topic?
Yeah, I mean, how I first got interested in it, I think, is the way that many people, including probably many of the listeners, got interested in it, which is through Star Trek and other science fiction as I was growing up. And that inspired me to go for a degree in astronomy and astrophysics when I was doing my college degree in undergrad. And then while I was doing that undergrad degree at UC Berkeley, I got involved with the Berkeley SETI Research Center and the Breakthrough Listen project over there. And, you know, it's kind of an odd field. It's a small field, but I figured I would stick with it as long as I could. And so far, that's been successful. And I just really love the creativity and the kind of technical side of the work of this part of astrobiology.
Very cool. I'm curious, just, you know, I know this is going to be a little off topic, but briefly, in the headlines lately, there's been this news about the Mars rover Perseverance, I believe, discovering some biosignatures in some rocks. And I'm just wondering, you know, has that been a big topic of discussion around your neck of the woods there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, technosignatures.
What's your take on it?
Yeah. Technosignatures are really just a subset of biosignatures, and we're all, you know, kind of united in trying to find life in different forms. And some SETI Institute researchers were involved in the recent Perseverance paper. So we've been talking about it a lot internally at the Institute. And, you know, with the caveat that I am not a chemist or a geologist, I would say this is still a really exciting discovery and something that is a good candidate for a potential biosignature, though my understanding is we'll need a lot more analysis and ideally analysis of samples that get brought back to Earth before we really know whether, you know, these little nodules and patterns are signs of life.
Yes, it's all very preliminary, and we've kind of had these kinds of things happen before, but this one does seem particularly tantalizing.
Yes, I would agree. I think, you know, as we send more and more instruments to other planets in our solar system, and as we develop more and more analysis techniques, we're discovering interesting things, and we have a bigger toolkit to actually, you know, rule out some of the more common non-life explanations. And some of that work has already been done. A lot of it still needs to be done. But it's definitely a very cool lead.
Very interesting. Well, we'll definitely want to keep track of that. Well, we asked you to be on today to talk to us about the Fermi paradox, which I've always found fascinating. And so could you just tell us briefly, like, how did Enrico Fermi become involved in SETI? Because it's got his name attached to us, and most of us who know who Enrico Fermi is, you know, the very famous physicist involved with the Manhattan Project. How did this come to be?
Yeah, I will say my understanding of the history here is, like, not necessarily fully complete, but Enrico Fermi wasn't really doing SETI work when he conceived of the Fermi paradox. And I think this kind of makes sense in a way, because as you pointed out, the Fermi paradox is something that is sort of broadly interesting. So you don't have to be a SETI researcher to find it a cool idea. But I believe the setup was that he was just talking with some colleagues while he was on the Manhattan Project, I believe, over lunch. And was just saying, like, okay, well, if there are these super quote unquote advanced civilizations of other life out there in the galaxy, then, you know, if they can send probes to their nearby stellar systems to explore them, we should see evidence of that. And if we don't see evidence of that, then here comes the short form of the Fermi paradox. Where is everybody?
Yes, my understanding of the story is that they'd maybe briefly been discussing it, because this is at 1950. And, you know, you're just starting to get the UFO craze kind of going in the United States and people thinking about these things. And Fermi was famous for his questions like this that were kind of unanswerable questions. Like, how many atoms from Caesar's breath do you think you've taken? Things like that. He loved to pose questions that cause his colleagues to think. And then he just supposedly blurted out, you know, where are they? And his friends all knew, like, exactly what he was talking about. I found that to be pretty funny.
Yes.
Well, you kind of stated the Fermi paradox. Kind of put it into little more concrete terms for us, you know, as far as SETI researchers goes. What is Fermi's paradox? Why is it a paradox?
Well, we'll probably get there a little later, but I would argue it isn't a paradox. The way that it's usually understood, I think, generally in 2025, is as a general, like, if we've been looking for alien life and specifically doing SETI since 1960, then why haven't we found anything yet? Why don't we have evidence of technological civilizations beyond Earth? And there are all sorts of explanations people have come up with, from, you know, maybe we're alone, maybe all civilizations destroy themselves and that's why we don't see them out there. Maybe we're being deliberately left out of a conversation because we're not ready, or something like that. All of which make incredible sci-fi stories. But I think from a scientist's perspective, we think of it more as a question of, like, what have we looked at already? And how much space do we still have to search before we can say anything conclusive about the presence of alien life in the galaxy? And that's where it gets, well, maybe a little more boring, but also a little more realistic.
And so let's go into that realistic aspect of it. You know, why do you think we have not yet made contact or been able to detect another civilization?
I'll answer that with sort of my favorite way to go about this, which is with a metaphor. So imagine that we're trying to search for life in all of Earth's oceans. So all of the water and all of the salt water and all of Earth's oceans. And if that's our search space, then what SETI has done up until, let's say, 1960 to 2000, was that we had searched about one drinking glass's worth of that entire multiple oceans worth of search space. And this calculation was actually redone around 2020. And we'd gone from a drinking glass up to about a small swimming pool's worth, maybe a large hot tub. So if you think about it that way, we've searched so little of the universe that, okay, we haven't seen anything in the parts that we've searched, but we're really just getting started.
Yes, Jill Tarter has used that analogy over the years, and I find it very compelling. Another one I like is from my friend Timothy Ferris, the science writer. And he did this in a PBS special he did, where he said it's a bit like, and he's dressed up in a beautiful tuxedo at an elegant restaurant. He says it's a bit like, you know, showing up for a lobster dinner, but nobody bothered to invite a lobster. You know, the odds of a lobster just showing up on my plate aren't very good.
Yeah, for sure. And to give it a little bit more sort of technicality, for us, we think of that search space as both physical space, like have we pointed our telescopes at every possible star or galaxy or point in the sky, but it's also frequency. So it's like if we're listening to the wrong channel, the wrong FM radio station, when they send their message on another one, even if we're pointed at the right place, we're going to miss it. If they send a message, you know, at midnight and we observe the target at noon. And so it kind of shows you how daunting the task is, where you have to look at every point on the sky, monitoring all of these different frequencies as often as you can. And you have to make some assumptions about what the signal will look like. But if you're making the wrong ones, again, you might miss it completely. So that is sort of the reason why it's been a pretty small amount of the space covered so far, is because for most of the time we've been doing these searches, we haven't had computers and telescopes capable of covering that much space at a time.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us as we continue our conversation with Sophia Shake, a researcher from the SETI Institute who specializes in searching for signatures of technology from possible alien civilizations. We'll continue our discussion of the Fermi paradox in just a moment. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening to Blue Dot. Let's continue now as we talk about the Fermi paradox, which asks the question of why we haven't detected signs of an alien civilization yet. Our guest is Sophia Shake, a researcher who specializes in searching for signatures of alien technology. I wonder if we flip the equation a bit and look at it from the other side. If there was a civilization, you know, more advanced or comparable to us that has radio telescope technology, the ability to detect, how difficult would it be for them somehow randomly in the Milky Way galaxy to find us?
I actually had a paper on this come out earlier this year, so I'll give that a plug. It's called Earth Detecting Earth.
Cool.
And it basically investigates exactly the question you posed, which is like, how detectable are we to a similar kind of technology level civilization somewhere else out there in the Milky Way? And I guess if I had to summarize it in one sentence, it would be, we are not that detectable. In order to see, say, our effect on our atmosphere or our city lights or, you know, our cell phone towers, like the messages that we send in general radio waves, the chatter all around the globe, you'd have to be within a couple light years for most of those things.
Oh, wow. That's very close.
Very close. Now, there is a really cool result that actually came out last week, 2 weeks ago, led by Pinchen Fan at Penn State. And her group instead looked at our highest power transmissions. So specifically, they looked at the Deep Space Network, which is a network of big transmitters that we use to communicate with, say, our Mars rovers.
Or Voyagers.
Yes, exactly. And for certain stars that are sort of in the part of the sky where they could eavesdrop on those transmissions, the odds are much higher of being detected and could be detected out to dozens of light years. Or in my paper, I make a slightly different assumption, maybe 100 and some light years. So basically, you have to get lucky and be in line with one of humanity's more powerful radio transmissions. But if you are, then we actually can be detectable at quite a distance.
How far?
The furthest one that I considered in my paper was transmissions from the, unfortunately, now defunct Arecibo telescope in Puerto Rico.
Right.
And when it was at its peak, sending out really strong radar pings to look for asteroids, those pings would bounce off the asteroid, but a lot of it would fly off into interstellar space. And if you had a receiver that was the size of the Square Kilometer Array, which is now being constructed on Earth in South Africa and Australia, then you could see this from thousands of light years away, basically halfway to the center of the galaxy.
Well, that definitely opens things up quite a bit.
Yes.
I always think to myself that, kind of a magic number for me would be about 1,500 light years away, because that's, kind of where we are in the galaxy, in our neck of the galaxy, as it were. And there's a lot of stars there.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Give us your take on how this question has evolved over time, and how much like the Drake equation, how it really is more useful as a tool for thinking about SETI rather than, the paradox itself.
Yeah, I think it can be a really useful vehicle for imagining different kinds of civilizations and societies, because we don't want to just make the assumption that all life out there in the galaxy is exactly like us. And so thinking about, what would you do if you were a billion-year-old civilization? What would that even mean? And what kinds of signatures might you create that could be detectable? I think the Fermi paradox helps us think about, as you sort of mentioned, Earth as a mirror, almost, what putting ourselves in someone else's shoes, looking at ourselves as just another exoplanet. And so I think that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is sort of quantifying, how much space have we searched? How well do we know what's in our own solar system, in our asteroid belt, in the Oort cloud? How well do we know our neighboring and nearby stars? And in many cases in SETI, if you go digging, you'll find not as well as you might think. There's still so much to do, in the field of astronomy and astrophysics generally. But when it comes to SETI, there's a lot of things that we haven't searched, a lot of new techniques just coming online. And those people work into the Fermi paradox and be like, okay, we've thought about this for radio signals, but what about for exoplanet atmospheric pollution? Or what about for laser signals? And so we keep expanding it to new techniques as we develop those new techniques in the SETI field.
Yes, it's almost like as great as our astrophysical mapping of the galaxy is, we're still might be somewhat in the there be dragons phase.
Yes.
So when you consider the Fermi paradox about, why aren't we detecting them everywhere? What are some of the interesting, you kind of mentioned some of them earlier, but what are some of the interesting answers to that, reasons why, why we haven't detected them? One that always has occurred to me is, there may be many worlds that are analogous to, ours, where there's intelligent life in the oceans, but that doesn't mean they're going to develop radio technology.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something we think about a lot. And a lot of the more fanciful solutions to the Fermi paradox, at least from the perspective of someone who does observational SETI. Like, I would say the more reasonable explanation is we still have a lot of searching to do. But that said, I think there are some other like assumptions in here that are interesting to tease out. One of them is what you mentioned, like intelligent life doesn't necessarily equal radio transmitting life. We have plenty of intelligent life in our own oceans, cetaceans like dolphins and whales, cephalopods, so octopi. And there are some interesting papers about tool use in these marine species. And it might not be advantageous or possible to develop radio signals to communicate underwater, but many whales will use things like clicks and vocalizations that can be heard halfway across an ocean. So why would you bother making a radio, you know, a cell tower when you can just make a sound tower? And that certainly wouldn't be detectable from outside of your own planet. I think there's another aspect here, which is there was sort of this running assumption in SETI for a while that advanced, quote unquote, equals always bigger, always consuming more energy, always more industry, more pollution. And this kind of came about sort of in the Cold War era. There was a lot of like the Great Acceleration and other industrial changes happening in our own society through the 60s, 70s, 80s. But now we're starting to rethink some of those assumptions and be like, okay, maybe as a billion-year-old civilization, what you really want to do is stabilize your climate. So, I don't know, every day is a perfect sunny beach day. You don't want to go out and terraform a bunch of rocks. Maybe you want to make your processes really efficient so you don't have a lot of waste products and pollution. And that would make you harder to detect from far away. So there are some authors who have talked about this as the sustainability solution to the Fermi paradox. And I do think it's an interesting perspective, which is that, you know, maybe more advanced doesn't always mean bigger and more obvious, but instead more advanced in subtler ways that, you know, we might appreciate right now, like making it so you don't have any hurricanes on your planet or things like that.
Or at least not exacerbating things like that.
That's a good first step.
And then another possibility, I suppose, is that as a civilization becomes more nuanced in their point of view, they also may choose to just not want to be detected.
Yeah, there are some papers that have explored different ways for civilizations to potentially, you know, hide their waste products, hide their planetary transits or their waste heat generated by like computing or other things. And it's definitely a possibility. It's interesting to run the math on and think about the ways that, you know, this could be done. But again, I think it's worth considering that Earth isn't that detectable in our current state. And maybe it's worth hiding your own signature, but also space is just so big. It takes so much energy. It's basically impossible for us to even get to our nearest star systems, although people have started thinking about ways that we could do this. And given the vastness of space, you need a really, really good reason to go somewhere that isn't your home stellar system. And so maybe you would spend a lot of time trying to mask your own signature so you're not bothered, but odds are you probably won't be bothered anyway, just because it's so hard to send mass between stellar systems.
Yes, it's an incredibly inefficient way. Thoughts can travel across the universe, but it's tough to send matter.
Yes, or at least it takes a very long time and it's not particularly efficient.
And of course, there are some people who think that, you know, they've already been here, you know, UFOs or UAPs or whatever you want to designate those things are. And I'm wondering, you know, from your point of view and your colleagues, you know, what do you make of all that?
I think I wouldn't speak of the SETI subfield as a monolith when it comes to this. Some of my colleagues are collaborating on NASA's like kind of UAP report that they have been working on. I would say from my point of view personally, there is nothing from sort of my training as a scientist and an astronomer that I've seen in any of those reports that are reproducible, that, you know, there's no real experiment that you can do. And so it's something that doesn't particularly interest me. I haven't seen anything that makes me think like, oh, that's going to be the way that we find life that originated beyond Earth. But I do find it much more likely that a lot of these reports are based on things like weather phenomena or military exercises or satellites or other more kind of terrestrial explanations.
Sophia Shake, Techno Signature Research Scientist from the SETI Institute, thanks for sharing your thoughts on the Fermi Paradox and your work with us. And this question that's as old as humanity is like, are we alone in the universe? Thanks for joining us.
Yes, pleasure to be here.
Thanks again to our guests from the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California, Deputy Director of the Carl Sagan Center for Research, Simon Steele, and Sophia Shake. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the SETI Institute who specializes in searching for technosignatures using the Allen Telescope Array in one of my favorite places, the Hat Creek Valley, just north of Lassen Volcanic National Park. You can learn more about their work at SETI.org. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. We're distributed by PRX. If you want to revisit, share, or check out past episodes, you can do just that on our website, mynspr.org. And while you're at it, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode on our website, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music, Big Wave Dave, is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.